This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
This is a great step, and I'm really happy that we were able to get a bipartisan agreement. Nobody's happy, but I think that's what happens in compromise. And so now it's to the people on the May ballot, and I hope they will consider supporting this.
House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, as his chamber passes a plan for redrawing Ohio's congressional districts, and he's right, it's not making everyone happy.
Mr. Speaker, I'm highly disappointed. And I know people sell this as, oh, Hamilton County, you're going to have a chance. In Hamilton County, not one African-American has been elected countywide. So keeping the county together is nice, but it's not a guarantee for more inclusion.
Representative Alicia Reese is among the critics of the plan, which now goes to the voters. Also on today's show, a former College Conservatory of Music professor is accused of sexual misconduct. We'll discuss these stories and more on today's weekly news review. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. First up, WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, and we'll be joined shortly by Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick. Again, you can join us, 513-419-7100. So, Jay, let's talk about the happenings at City Hall this week.
First off, Chris must be on a breaking business story.
He must be, yeah. Yeah, he said he's coming. He'll be here. So, City Manager Harry Black wants to delay responsible bidder regulations for city contractors. So first off, what is responsible bidder, Jay? What are these regulations he's talking about?
Well, essentially a responsible bidder was that you had the contractors that were bidding on city work that was more than $400,000 had to have a program for job training for new workers. And there was also another part of that any of those contracts also had to have a local hire component. And let's see, it was 30 to 40% of all those construction hours had to be given to local residents. And then there was another 20% of those construction hours that had to go to disadvantaged workers. So those were the two things together. And this was passed, it was either in the end of the Mallory administration or the beginning of the Cranley administration, and it was challenged in court. And a federal appeals court recently ruled the lawsuit was about the responsible bidder portion. And the appeals court ruled that they did have the ability to enforce this
law. So they could move forward with putting this law into effect.
So they could put this into effect. Well, then what happened? The city manager said, well, he issued a memo this week, and he was concerned that the responsible bidder portion could have an adverse impact on the efforts that the city has made to increase contracts that are going to minority-owned firms and women-owned businesses. And so he had asked that it be put on hold until they had a chance to review this. He was suggesting that it be put on hold until September the 12th.
Could this go beyond just a delay, do you think, Jay? Or?
I don't think the votes are there for that. Matter of fact, I'm not even sure. Basically, it is law, so it's an ordinance. And the city administration had prepared basically an emergency ordinance to suspend it till September the 12th. And I don't think the votes are there to pass even a suspension. What I was hearing from council members this week is, yeah, they may look at take time to do a study, but they didn't think that it needed to be 6 months. They were thinking more like 6 weeks. And so I don't think the votes are there to temporarily suspend it.
So essentially what the city manager is saying that we've got these two programs that are trying to accomplish something good, but they're at odds with each other.
He says that's his message, that they are at odds with one another and they want to take some time to review and see. I mean, he says he wants responsible bidder to work. They want to take the time to see, you know, how they can mesh the two programs together.
Who on council supports responsible bidder, Jay?
Mostly the Democrats. Councilmember Seelbach has probably been the most ardent supporter. And he says that in a text this week when we were writing about this, that, you know, while there have been improvements in the minority and women-owned business contracts going to these businesses, most of those have not been local. Most of those have been out of the county.
Yeah. Chris, good afternoon. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Breaking business story that held you up?
No. Well, you never know. But.
We were talking about the responsible bidder and how Harry Black is asking that these regulations be put on hold until September. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
You know, interestingly enough, Councilman Seelbach is not having any of this. He's kind of opposed. I mean, he is opposed to it, to delaying these responsible bidder provisions. And you know, he believes that the city's record on responsible bidder you know, is abysmal, and he'd like to see, you know, he'd like to see more people able to get jobs through these apprenticeship programs. So, you know, I think there might be a little bit of a fight when this comes to council.
We were talking before you got here. I'm not even sure that they've got the votes to temporarily suspend it.
No, I don't know that they do either. You know, when the manager put the memo out, you know, he really provided a lot of detail, and he gave an example of a company that they tried to hire to do some work at Waterworks, and or not a company, but a bid that they put out, and there were apparently four or five bidders or four or five people that came to the information meeting, and then nobody actually bid on it. And this was not because of the responsible bidder, but it was because of another provision in it called local hire, which focuses on hiring city and residents of Hamilton County as well. So it was attempting to be quite a persuasive memo. I don't think some folks on council are persuaded, and I don't think another example is the NAACP. They're not persuaded either that these two things can't coexist together.
So if I have this straight, Jay, because you said earlier it's already an ordinance.
It's already an ordinance.
So if they don't pass what the city manager is requesting, it takes effect. Is that what happens?
Well, it's to be implemented, and then that brings up another question. If the city manager chooses not to follow the law, basically I think a council member's only resource would be to file a lawsuit against the city manager for not enforcing the ordinance. That's where it gets a little bit murky.
And they're in conflict with each other, right? Or they potentially are.
Potentially.
And so I don't, you know, I guess it's up to the manager to decide which one he follows. And Jay's right, they'll kind of have to litigate it potentially. We'll see.
And I think an undercurrent here that we're probably not hearing about, this could likely be the beginning of framing of issues for the next mayoral race in 2021. Because it's widely expected that the two contenders at this point that we know of, at least, that could be in that race are Councilmember P.G. Sittenfeld, who has supported responsible bidder, and the major opponent who has talked at length against responsible bidder is the current vice mayor, Christopher Smitherman. So part of me thinks that this is laying the groundwork, framing issues, getting our talking points for the mayor's race in 2021.
It's so exhausting. We just finished a mayor's race, and we're already into the second one, or the next one.
It's a never-ending cycle, isn't it? So you're talking about, as far as the people who oppose this, like Christopher Smitherman, what reasons are they giving for being against this?
They think that it could drive up contracting costs because basically it could potentially limit the pool of companies who are able to bid on projects.
There's another reason, too. There's concern that that basically there are African-American, women-owned, minority-owned firms that don't have these apprenticeship programs, that aren't able to graduate one apprentice per year for the last 5 years, can't meet those requirements, and that basically it excludes them. And that kind of was one of the arguments that they made all along. It's worth noting that, you know, Christopher Smitherman's brother, Albert Smitherman, has a company called Jostin. So, you know, there may be concern related to businesses like that. So, you know, that's an issue.
But next up is a vote, or maybe not a vote.
Right. Unless it was filed today, I looked and I did not see the ordinance that the manager had attached to his memo in the city council system. Now, it may end up there, but then it would have to go to committee. My guess is that it's going to go to a committee where Mr. Smitherman is a member, and that would probably be economic growth and zoning. It probably will pass out of committee, and then if it gets that far and gets to council, I still don't see how it's going to get five votes for approval.
You know, another question out there, you know, the laborers came out with a statement against this, or maybe it was the NAACP, whose president is Rob Richardson Sr., and he is also a major official in the Laborers International Union. I'd be interested to see if other unions are as strongly against delaying this as the laborers are. The mayor had quite a bit of labor support, both on the public employee side and the private employer side. So, you know, we'll see if folks like the carpenters or, you know, plumbers and pipe fitters, you know, there's a number of trade unions that do business that, you know, with contractors that would do business with the city that would be affected by this. So we'll see what they say.
Now, 1 month into his first term on city council, Jeff Pastor came out this week. He says he wants to resign from the Budget and Finance Committee. Now, isn't it pretty traditional, Jay, that everybody on council serves on that particular committee?
Well, since I knew you were probably going to ask that, I went back and did my homework.
Good for you.
Glad somebody did. And I can only go back to 2001, and I was kind of surprised. I thought that it was more of a tradition, but from 2001 through 2011, the number of people on the Finance Committee ranged from 6 to 8. So from that, 10 years there, not all 9 members were on the Budget and Finance Committee. But then starting with the term that began in December of 2011 and through until January of this year, all 9 council members have traditionally been a part of the Budget and Finance Committee. It's not required. I think the only requirement in the rules is that each council member must serve on 3 committees, and with his other committee assignments, he's still doing that. But in a statement, he said that he wants to spend more time focused on his role as chairman of the Neighborhoods Committee. He talked about helping neighborhood business districts and improving customer service to city residents.
Yeah, have you heard anything about why he wants off, Chris?
I talked to Jeff the other day about this, and basically, the first thing he wanted to emphasize is that he's not breaking the rules. The 3 committee assignment requirement is being met. And then the second thing is, he just feels, that he can do more good.
Like Jay was saying.
Right. I mean, I didn't hear anything really that was markedly different than what Jay just said.
Does he need approval from the rest of council?
I think he does have to file a motion, but that's just a formality. It'll be introduced. He'll ask to be removed. It has to go to, I forget which committee has the rules now. They've changed them around.
I think it's Landsman's committee.
It'll have to
major go, projects.
But basically, once it's approved, then he would be off the committee. And again, for all purposes, it probably doesn't mean a whole lot. It's probably a bigger deal to us as reporters because basically, if you had all 9 council members on that committee, if they voted for it on Monday committee day, then you pretty well knew what the outcome was going to be on Wednesday. If it was something that was close when they took the full council vote.
What happens if they get a tie, Jay? What happens if he does get off this committee, if it's a 4-4 tie, how do they handle that?
I think there's a rule that says that it's up at the discretion of the mayor. The item can be put on the agenda without recommendation, then it goes to the full council.
Or the mayor can reassign it.
Right.
To a different committee.
To a committee where it will be approved.
And when you sit there and handicap the council right now, I mean, Jeff is people presume and – the limited number of votes we've had so far kind of indicate he's going to be in the Smitherman-Murray, group of folks, conservative side of council. That's 3 members. There'd always have to be 2 Democrats that vote with the 3 of them in order for stuff to go forward that they would want. So, the math, it doesn't seem to really affect the Budget and Finance Committee math a whole lot. I mean, potentially there could be 4-4 votes, and that would cause something interesting to happen maybe, but I'm not sure.
Meantime, Chris, you had this interesting Twitter feud break out this week between new council member Pastor and veteran council member Chris Seelbach. What was this particular Twitter feud over?
choose your words carefully.
It goes back to the county clerk of courts, Aftab Purival, running for the U.S. House. And after he announced, the day that he announced that decision, he announced it at a church? I'm not even sure. It was Gabriel's Place. I don't know if that counts as a church or not, but
I think
it's a religious organization.
But it was during the work day at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Correct. And the Republicans made a big deal about how Aftab Purival, when he became clerk of courts, said, we shouldn't have campaign work or we shouldn't have people doing campaign work on county time, which is pretty much obvious to anybody. So anyway, when he announces at 10 o'clock in the morning, he presumably is on county time when he does that. And so they felt that was hypocritical and they criticized him for it. So the other day when President Trump was here, Jeff Pastor and Amy Murray, both members of council, went to the president's speech during the workday. And Seelbach maintained on Twitter that this was a political rally and that they were doing the same thing that Aftab Purival did. Well, Jeff got pretty bent out of shape about that. And basically said that Seelbach was bullying him, that he reminded him of his, stepfather? Uh-huh. Yeah, it was pretty, emotional tweeting, and that Seelbach was bullying him, and that he was a basically a white hipster racist. And so that kind of was the explosive back and forth on social media for the week that everybody got to talk about. In
the meantime, the city still has, what, a $22 million deficit it has to close.
Right.
Well, and
right.
That was part of the – and that's what led to part of the Twitter thing with Pastor and Murray gone on Monday. One other council member was gone. So
I forgot about this.
So yeah. The Budget and Finance Committee had six members to start, and a couple of them left before the meeting was over. So that took six down to four. You have to have five for a quorum. So there were like five items that they couldn't vote on because they didn't have a quorum. So they ended up having a special meeting on Wednesday before the council meeting to approve what needed to be approved so it could be voted on council. But I mean, yeah, that probably it shouldn't happen, but it happens all the time.
Are squabbles like this just a distraction to the work that they need to get done?
It's show business, you know. Yeah. It's show business.
And and again, it's probably politics and looking ahead to 2021.
You know, Jeff felt that one of my stories during the campaign about his business dealings and jobs was not – he didn't like that, and he said that was a racist story. So, yeah, you know, in this day and age, with the president being who it is, people get called a lot of names.
Chris says something happened with the streetcar this week. It turns out that freezing weather, ice, and – snow just don't mix well with the streetcar.
Boy, another one of my favorite topics, right?
Yeah. What happened?
Well, you were in a tweet storm on this.
Yeah. The light.
Yeah, hey, there was an actual storm and then a tweet storm that followed. So,
the lines above the streetcar that power it were frozen as a result of the ice storm. And basically, what happened was the streetcar could not move. And so, the way that they deal with this problem when there's going to be an ice storm is they run one streetcar 24 hours a day, and it keeps the ice off of the lines. Unfortunately, what happened was there was apparently a Duke truck and maybe some other vehicles that were blocking the streetcar line in the middle of the night or in the late evening or whatever. And so, during the course of getting those folks to move, the lines ended up freezing, and the streetcar was stuck there. And so that led to the last 2 days, actually not today, but the two previous days, the streetcar being towed around in a tow truck with a tow truck in front of it to try to clear this ice off the line. And so it makes us look, you know, really silly. It makes the project, it's probably one of the worst images of it so far, I think.
Yeah, is there anything that could be done to keep this kind of thing from happening again?
Yeah, I mean, they can not have trucks block the streetcar lane when we're going to have an ice storm. The other thing is, you know, there's other, like, things they could do. They could have a truck with a line with what they call a pantograph attached to the line and theoretically clear, you know, make sure the ice doesn't do that again. So, you know, it was just a whole mess.
Does it – it seems like to me it just seems like that the streetcar is – this whole project is crying out for somebody to take charge and for no
show
pun
some
here,
leadership.
Show some leadership. That's one pun, but get it back on track. And so far, it doesn't. It's not happening.
Well, you know, it's a function of the way that they have it managed partially, right? Yeah, you have the city that owns it. You have the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority, which oversees the operations, and then you have TransDev, which is a third-party private company that is actually operating it every day. So, you know, you could stereotype and say nobody's in charge, but I mean, you know, basically sort of is in charge of making sure it operates every day. But you do have these different management things that are kind of conflicting with each other. And, you know, this is kind of another one of those freak things that happen, you know, when you have, you know, people like to, you know, say, oh, the streetcar's always crashing. Well, actually, motorists are always crashing into it. I don't believe there's been an instance yet where the streetcar was cited for crashing into someone. It's usually somebody driving that crashes into it. So,
well, you got to admit, though, that there have been a string of problems the streetcar has run into since it started. Is city council saying anything about this, Jay?
That's just what I was getting ready to say. It's been interesting that since the new council has been seated, there has not been one committee hearing on the streetcar, and it's going to be interesting to see how long, because they were happening monthly at the Major Transportation and Government Cooperation Committee. They'd come in once a month and go through all the problems. That hasn't happened since the beginning of the year, and it's interesting to see how long that goes before they actually bring this up to a council committee and start wading through these the issues with the cars are having problems, the freezing rain on the lines.
On the lines, yes.
So it's going to be interesting to see how long we go into the year before somebody has a hearing on this.
It's interesting because Greg Landsman, who's in charge of the streetcar through the major projects committee, you know, he's more of a guy that says, let's get everybody in a room and figure this out, and then we'll come out and tell you what the solution is. He's not kind of the guy who, you know, is going to have a public hanging of the streetcar every other week, you know, that we were accustomed to last term. So I'll be interested to see how he handles it.
Chris and Jay, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Ohio voters will get their say on a new plan for redrawing Ohio's congressional districts. Joining us now, Ohio Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, Andy.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, he used the word compromise when he was talking about this agreement. So I'm wondering, what's the backstory? I mean, how much back and forth did they have to go through to reach this particular deal?
Well, it depends if you want the long story or the really long story. the backstory of all of this is, let's start here. Starting last year, there was a citizens group that was circulating petitions to try to get something on this fall's ballot that would change the way the congressional district lines are drawn. And also, a couple years ago, Governor Kasich said that he wanted some type of reform of the same way. So Republican leadership in the House and Senate said, the governor's been calling for this. The citizens group has been calling for this. We better get together, come up with a plan that we like before it's out of our hands.
So he said, let's get it done. And then yes. They just barely squeaked in ahead of a deadline, if I understand correctly.
You know, and you just kind of knew it was going to happen. They're not going to let anything, they're not going to waste any days, minutes, hours without a little bit more tweaking, a little bit more negotiating. And I think what we've seen with these really big deals, because we saw the way state districts were drawn a couple years ago, or the way the process was reformed a couple years ago, is that you have to have these deadlines. They usually end up coming down to the wire because that's the only thing that's really motivating them to get it done in the first place, is that they have this ticking clock. So, yeah, they had to get it done by Wednesday. They officially passed it on Tuesday, so they had one day left in the whole process.
Sure, that's all you need, right? So, what exactly does this plan do?
So the whole idea of this is to change the process to which congressional districts are drawn to make sure that even if you're not the majority party, even if you're not the party that controls the House, the Senate, the party that's sitting in the governor's office, that you still have a say in what the map looks like. That way you can't gerrymander. That way you don't just draw the lines to favor one party over another. So with this process, it requires that you have to get some buy-in from the minority party. So it's kind of set up into four different rounds, four different attempts at making a map. The first go-around, it has to pass with a 3/5 majority of the whole House and of the whole Senate, but it also requires at least 50% approval from the minority party. And so that's the first step. That's ideally the way you get a map done, is through that first step. Then they have a second, third, and fourth step down the line that also requires some type of buy-in from the minority party. But if you just can't get it, if the maps were being made this year, Republicans are in control, the Democrats are in the minority. If you're trying to create a map and you just couldn't get enough votes from Democrats, then the majority party could create a map without buy-in from the minority. But then certain criteria kicks in, the way it's written out in this resolution, certain criteria kicks in to make sure that you still are not gerrymandering a map.
So it's going to limit the way that counties will be split, I take it.
That's the big discussion. And that was the big point of conflict in these negotiations, was just how much splitting of counties could you do? And in the long run, basically, they want to make sure that if you're a small county with not a big population, don't cut it at all. If you're a county with just a mid-level population, you're allowed to cut it once. And then if you're a really big county, then you're allowed to cut it twice, meaning three individual congressional districts within that one county.
So this would be, what, a 10-year, a plan for drawing up a 10-year map? Is that?
Yeah. So going back to those four attempts at making a map, if you're able to make a map within one of those three, they kept calling it silos. If you're able to make it in, under one of those things with some sort of minority buy-in, then it becomes a 10-year map. If you can't get the minority party to buy into it, if you can't get their approval, then it's only a 4-year map. And the whole idea behind that is, if you're the party that's creating this map in the majority, you want to make sure that the map is working for you and that it's a 10-year map, because you don't know if you will be in the majority 4 years down the line.
Andy, the group that was, I think it was working on its own plan at the same time that the House was working on this plan. What was that? Common Cause Ohio, I believe.
That's part of it. Yeah, it was a coalition of groups. Common Cause was one of them. Overall, the coalition was named Fair Districts Equal Fair Elections.
How did they react to this new plan?
Well, they're all for it. And the really interesting thing about this whole process, like we said, it's been a long time coming. The really interesting thing in these past couple of weeks is that in the room negotiating these deals, it was not just the Democrats and Republicans, but also these citizen groups at the table discussing this. And in the end, you could really tell from the plan that came out of it that this citizens group had probably a lot of leverage going into it, because at any point they could say, if we don't like this plan, we have the signatures, we're just going to take this to the fall ballot. So in the end, they were able to leverage that and get a lot of what they wanted out of it. So they're in support of it.
So Representative Alicia Reese from Cincinnati was taking issue with the plan because she thinks this is going to make it harder for minorities in Hamilton County to be fairly represented. That's her criticism of it. She's concerned about inclusion. What are other critics saying?
I think if you look at what people are saying, it's just nobody got everything that they wanted out of it. The Republicans wanted a little bit more control for the majority party. The Democratic Party wanted some things in place. What Representative Reese was saying was that she just wanted one amendment added to the bill or to the resolution, and that was that it is a right to vote, that voting in Ohio is a right. She didn't get that, and that's something that she's been working on for years now. So I think the people who were against it, the people who came out against it, they see this as not getting the whole piece of the pie that they've been looking for the past couple of years. And so I think the people who did vote against it also are using this issue to springboard into that next step that they're going to fight for. Because we've heard redistricting for several years now. What's the next issue when it comes to elections advocacy? And I think just the Voter Rights Act and the right to vote is maybe that next step.
And just to be clear, I think you mentioned this earlier, but just to be clear, we're talking about the congressional districts in Ohio.
Right. Just the congressional districts, because Ohio voted in 2015 to reform the apportionment board the way that state legislative districts are drawn. So according to both parties are happy with the process to which state legislative districts are drawn already because of that issue that passed in 2015. So this is just for Congress.
So is this going to be on the May ballot? Is that definite yet?
It's definitely going to be on the May ballot. They passed it on Tuesday. They sent it over to the Secretary of State's office, and Secretary of State John Husted posted a picture of him signing it. So it should be all good to go. We don't know what kind of campaigning it's going to be like at this point. We don't know, what's going to happen at this point. But it seems like that group we were talking about earlier, the Fair Elections, Fair Districts, or Fair Districts Equal Fair Elections, I think they're going to put some campaign support behind it to get it passed in May. Yeah.
And what if this particular plan doesn't pass? What happens then?
That's a good question. I mean, if it doesn't pass, then the coalition can still take the signatures that they've gathered so far, collect more signatures, and try to put their issue on the November ballot. And that's definitely something that they're keeping in mind. They're not doing anything with those signatures. They're gonna keep those on hold to see what happens. And I think they're going to be listening to the voters to see. I mean, if it were not to pass in May, it would be because of some sort of glaring reason, we would think. And so I think that that coalition would try to take a look at what voters didn't like and then tweak their plan to what voters might like.
So it might be on the November ballot then.
It could still be on the November ballot if it doesn't pass. It all depends on what voters have a problem with, I think.
Andy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow. World-renowned flutist Bradley Garner, a former professor at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, has been accused of sexual harassment of students spanning two decades. Cincinnati Inquirer investigative and enterprise editor Cindy Andrews and higher education reporter Kate Murphy join us now. And you can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Cindy, good afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
And Kate, thank you.
Yeah,
good afternoon to you. Tell us a little bit more about Bradley Garner, who he is and how integral he was in UC's program at CCM.
Yeah, so Bradley Garner is one of the most famous flutists in the world, really. You know, students talk about him like he was a household name among young flutists. He was the first flutist to get a doctoral degree from the Juilliard School and, you know, came to CCM to really turn that studio into one of the most prominent in the country. And, you know, he did that over the course of a couple decades. You know, his supervisors and administrators at CCM really commended, you know, the work that he was really able to turn that studio into one of the most sought out for young flutists to really launch their careers.
So if you want to study flute, this would be the guy you'd want to study under, Cindy.
Absolutely. His students went on to perform in Washington, D.C., Buenos Aires, all over the world. And they went on to teach at places like OSU and colleges and universities across the country and the world. So obviously, flutists, like any other student, are looking for how to make a career. And his students had a proven track record of going on to greatness.
So how did this story come to light, Kate?
So we heard that there was, you know, something involving Bradley Garner going on at the university. And so we, you know, requested records from the university and received a pretty large file of an investigative report that that Title IX investigators had conducted. And, you know, so it began, the investigation really began from two student complaints that came forward in October of 2016. And, you know, they sought help from a faculty member and the dean of CCM at the time to kind of explain that, you know, the behavior that they were experiencing and the harassment that was going on in the studio. So they went to the Title IX office, who then immediately opened an investigation and, you know, completed that investigation in about 2 months. And found, you know, a lot of instances from these students, you know, that they were being inappropriately touched and texted and, you know, just really creating a sexually hostile environment within that studio. And, you know, they interviewed 21 students and a couple faculty members to kind of get into what it was really like to be in that studio and, you know, the different accusations that came across. And so then in, you know, February of 2017, they decided that he should be fired based on that report. And then he, you know, they went through the disciplinary process at the school. And in December of 2017, Garner actually retired before kind of that disciplinary process was over. And so we had, you know, seen that he had retired and decided to look further into that as to why, which is when kind of the report came into our hands. And, you know, so really just took digging through that investigative report to look at all the different accusations, the extent of it, the pervasiveness, how severe these accusations were, and, you know, saw that they included multiple students, spanned, you know, up to two decades.
How far back?
Back into the mid-90s. And then we also talked with many of the students who were directly involved and some who weren't included in the report that were never interviewed by UC, but, you know, described their experiences dating back to 1995. And so that was really just to see the pervasiveness of it. And, you know, it didn't just happen at CCM. You know, the report found multiple students who were minors when they met Garner. You know, they met him when they were 15 years old at flute festivals and retreats and were really starstruck. And even at that time, were kind of experiencing the uncomfortability and the inappropriate comments from him, which they described in a lot of detail in that report.
What started UC's investigation? Was it just complaints, or did somebody notice something going on in that department that made them say, we need to see what's happening here?
Right. So it's actually really interesting how it came about. New department head who wasn't even involved with the flute studio at all was looking over enrollment data and noticed that there was a little bit of a drop in the flute studio. And she started talking about that with her graduate assistants. And one of them said, I think I might know why, and kind of told her what he had heard about sexual harassment, rumors about Bradley Garner. And she said, well, if those women want to come talk to me, I'm all ears. And so she, you know, basically heard this one thing, asked to talk to these students, and that day went and told someone at UC what she had heard. Which was really, really key in kind of launching this entire investigation. You know, those students felt comfortable enough that they went to talk to her and she believed them and then did something about it, which, you know, UC said that they had never received a complaint before that. But that was really what launched, you know, this investigation was a faculty member and a dean believing these students and reporting it to the UC along with those two initial students who came forward.
Yeah, Cindy, how difficult was it for the women to come forward and tell these stories?
Well, you know, I think we've seen with this whole Me Too movement that how incredibly difficult it almost always is for a woman to step forward and talk about somebody who has control over her career and her reputation. And so these women were certainly no different. Kate interviewed them, and you know, in most cases, we have not published their names to honor their request, because they're still fearful of being exposed, and they're in many cases women who still hope to have a career in the flute world. And Bradley Garner was very powerful in that world. There's still actually, while a couple of other places have dropped their connections with him, Yamaha Music has dropped him as an artist, and New York University has dropped him as an adjunct professor. But there's actually a flute retreat in North Carolina that teaches underage students and others that is standing by him and continues to say, you know, this whole investigation was crap. Can I say that on the air?
Oh, and, go ahead.
sorry, FCC. So you're seeing playing out in real life why there would be such reluctance, because there are people who still say he's a great guy, he's a great musician, and we don't believe you.
Yeah. Now, the instances of misconduct that are being reported, Kate, were these like in a classroom setting, were these more in private lesson type settings, or what are we talking about here?
Yeah. So it's interesting. The unique relationship between professors and instructors in, you know, the music industry is much different than, you know, just going to a giant lecture, you know, at UC in a math lecture. You know, these are very intimate relationships that, you know, you're learning under this one person. And, you know, there are sometimes private lessons. Other times there would be two students in a room who he's teaching at the same time. And then he also does what are called master classes, where, you know, a couple students will perform and he'll basically do a lesson in front of, you know, a group of other students. And so it's just a really unique kind of relationship and mentorship between a professor and an aspiring musician that they're relying so much on this person and are learning in such close quarters. And, you know, a lot of them are their weekly lessons, and you could spend hours at a time with this one person, either alone or with just one other person in a room. And that's what kind of, you know, they talked about left them vulnerable, because they felt like he could say or do anything that he wanted.
Is UC talking about changing any of that to protect students, to changing the way that students are instructed, Kate?
They have not. And I think that it's certainly the norm in, you know, the classical music industry and for other students and professors, like that's very normal for how you would learn with an individual, especially at the doctoral and master's level, which many of these students were learning with him. And so it's, you know, it's kind of just the way that it works, because you want to really get that individualized lesson to, you know, I mean, you're becoming a professional at that point.
But you do raise an interesting question in asking what UC's reaction to this has been, because that's been something that has been a little bit slow to show itself. UC certainly did give us the records in regards to our public records request, as they're required to by law, but they have had very little to say about this beyond their spokesperson, who has answered a couple of questions. We've not heard from the university president on this. We've not heard from the dean of CCM, and we would certainly love to get their feedback on do they think that anything should be done differently, and that anything could have been done to prevent, you know, potentially, you know, a situation of sexual harassment. It's you know, not proven at this point, but for as long as 2 decades without anybody being aware of it.
Yeah, well, because when you're talking about these private one-on-one lessons, I mean, that's a situation that could very easily be abused.
Certainly, you in doctor's offices, right? If you have a male doctor now, or sometimes even a female doctor, they've begun to take precautions. So you see it in other industries, and I do think it will be interesting to see whether some things change as these kinds of stories continue to unfold, because this Bradley Garner is not the first person in the classical music industry to be accused of this kind of behavior. James Levine, who had started out here in Cincinnati at the May Festival and is one of the premier conductors in the world, has also been subject to accusations, and I would not be surprised if we heard more about other areas of the music world that this kind of behavior has gone on.
Kate, what's Garner's reaction to the accusations? Have we heard his response to this?
We have not heard directly from him. Certainly, we've, you know, reached out, and through his attorney, he has, you know, denied all of the allegations, and is, you know, really very critical of the investigation itself. But no, we have not heard from him directly.
Well, and we have a sworn affidavit from mm-hmm. him that he provided to UC as part of their investigation, in which he goes into much more detail in denying the charges, and in some cases being critical of the students who had stepped forward to make the accusations and to sort of comment on their abilities as musicians and students.
Is one of his arguments to due process?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That he's also mentioned,
yeah,
as well.
I mean, and that was really for him, you know, mm-hmm. according to his retirement letter and, you know, the numerous statements that he made, that's the reason that he retired. You know, he felt that he was not given due process in, you know, throughout the investigation and, you know, throughout the disciplinary hearing process. So that, at the end of the day, is the reason that he left UC.
Which is interesting, though, because in retiring before the grievance process was completed, you know, he has not been found, you know, he avoided being fired. And if we had not gotten a tip, you know, this story started as a single tip, anonymous tip to the newspaper, which is how some of the greatest journalism does start. And please find us and let us know if you've got a great story. Cindy Andrews, Kate Murphy, Inquirer. You know, the...
He was never found responsible of anything. So,
right, because Title IX is, I guess, it's more of a civil issue, right? It wouldn't be guilty or not guilty, but whether
correct.
He was responsible.
But even
or not.
In that case, it was never resolved,
right?
Because he retired.
Because he retired before
yeah.
anything else.
So there was no formal discipline.
If we hadn't found this story, he would not be teaching at UC, but he would probably still be an adjunct professor at Northern.
Wow. New York University.
New York University, yeah.
And yeah, and still is affiliated with Yamaha, still having much of the power over young women and young flautists.
But he's not at New York University anymore, and Yamaha, I think,
right. Yeah, has dropped
also...
their affiliation, yeah.
So what's been the reaction to this story?
It's been really awesome to see the reaction and the support that these girls and young women are receiving from fellow flutists. You know, it really has, there's been so much widespread talk on social media in the flute community and so many people, you know, not necessarily saying that they've experienced it themselves, but really supporting these women and things that they've heard and to just see that it wasn't, you know, an isolated incident thing that happened one time, that there were multiple people who were impacted, who were telling their stories, and people are really standing by them. And that's really, you know, unfortunate that so many people are saying that they're not shocked by this. It's really nice to see that these young women aren't being ostracized by the community that they've worked so hard to be a part of. And, you know, hopefully that their careers take off and this can, you know, kind of be something that they can just move on from and pursue their careers, which is, you know, the whole reason for coming to CCM in the first place.
A couple of flutists started a petition, which is up over.
There's more than 400 signatures now that two flutists started that they are, you know, trying to have Bradley Garner banned from ever teaching or giving lessons again. And they're sending it to the National Flute Association, which is, you know, obviously a very big organization in that world, which Garner was actually on the board of directors of back in the 90s and is, you know, very influential within that organization. So they have sent that to the National Flute Association and are hoping to... you know, hear back from them. And yeah, more than 400 people have signed that.
Yeah, is there the possibility that this becomes a criminal matter?
Yeah. So we learned yesterday that Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters is meeting with UC to look into this investigation and, you know, see if there are anything that they can do based on the UC investigation. And UC did involve their own police department while they were investigating. So they worked kind of hand in hand with the Title IX office. And so Joe Dieters is kind of taking that a step further and seeing if there's any, you know, criminal things that he can look into from a criminal perspective.
And Kate and Cindy will be following up with you on this more later. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thanks very much.
Cincinnati Inquirer investigative and enterprise editor Cindy Andrews and higher education reporter Kate Murphy. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.